Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, John Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this Friday, July the 17th on the West Coast, July the 18th on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zone. So nice to have you with us. This is a special night because we always bring back our resident science advisor, Mr. Jim Murray, who also happens to be not just a scientist, but an inventor extraordinaire, I must say. He's got some really off-the-wall inventions that would really do the world a service right now if the powers that be weren't so greedy. And he's also an author, a lecturer, and teacher, and going to bring him on right now, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show tonight.
Hey, thank you, Don. How are you tonight?
I'm doing real well. Hope you're doing well, and hope everything is going well with your work. I know you've been very busy, Tesla man that you are. And we're going to continue our 153rd, was it? 153rd birthday celebration of Nikola Tesla from last week, and we're going to continue a bit more tonight, and cover some ground that we didn't cover last week. And this could go on every week as far as I'm concerned. So what did you bring with you tonight?
Well, actually, I was pretty animated by last week's show. You know, that happens to me every time we get into an extended discussion about Nikola Tesla's work. And during the course of the week, I was musing on some of that material, and it seems to me that one of the most, there's a couple of areas that are usually looked upon either with great disdain by the scientific community or with great wonder by the populace in general. And those two areas of exploration is the wireless transmission of power, which, you know, I can understand how that would be quite quite a complexity to the average individual. And also, Tesla's dynamic theory of gravity, which he later professed was the concept which allowed him to design his airships. He called them airships, you know, but if you were to read the description of these devices from all of our recognized characteristics that we attribute to UFOs, you would almost have to assume that he was talking about some type of spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two areas I thought would be interesting to explore further. And then I also dug into my copious files, most of which are still in New Jersey, but some of which I brought along with me to Oklahoma. And I found a copy of a letter which I obtained back in, I think it was 77, through an associate of Otis Carr's, which shed some light on the thinking that went into the design of the OTCX-1.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I thought I would discuss certain aspects of that tonight is because it was written by a priest. And this guy, I don't know if he was a PhD or not, but he definitely had more than a passing familiarity with some pretty advanced physical concepts.
Now, it wasn't Father Flanagan, was it?
No, definitely not. He had his hands full with other matters.
All right.
But the reason I bring it up is because this guy was a very enigmatic figure, and it took me, it took 12 years in my spare time to try to track him down, simply because he endorsed the Carr Project and seemed to have so much knowledge about the relationship between magnetism, electricity, and gravity, and could never find a hide the hair of the guy. So I thought that those things would make for some interesting discussions tonight.
Sure. I had no idea what priest it would have been. I just thought of the first name that came to my mind. You know, it's Friday night. We can have fun tonight and enjoy this. So I might mention, Jim, we are being heard around the world, by the way. So there are folks in Russia, Australia, Ireland, and points in between that are hearing us, as well as South America and Hawaii. Lots of people in the military. So this is going to be a really, really interesting show for them.
Well, that's good, and the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned, as you well know. I think that there's a lot to this work that was done by Nikola Tesla, which really deserves to get out there. And the guy did a lot more than, you know, than make big sparks, which is what he's best remembered for. But it takes a certain amount of not only investigation, but the proper presentation of the guy's work relative to how it affects our daily lives before people begin to get the gist of the magnitude of this man's genius.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't be too critical of the people who just don't know. But on the other hand, there's no excuse not to inform them.
Sure, I agree. And there's no reason for those that know about Tesla's work to stop us from knowing it. On the other hand.
Well, that depends on which side of the fence you're on. I'm very sure that the elite don't want the commoners to know too much about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They've made that pretty evident over the years, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Well, that's why we have this show. just to do what the elite don't like us to do. So have at it, Jim. It's all yours.
Well, okay, I thought I would start off with some interjections concerning Tesla's dynamic theory of gravity. You know, the guy never made much mention about that until Einstein started coming out with his special theory of relativity and his belief that gravity was, in a simplified way, was explained by a four-dimensional centrifugal force, for all intents and purposes. And that necessitated that space be curved. And this just seemed to raise the hair on Tesla's head because, as I mentioned in last week's show, I believe that during that accident in Colorado Springs, that he definitely discovered the nature of gravity. And he was very, very adamant about the fact that it was a force field which could be produced at will if you understood the mechanism, and that it could be engineered, you know, just like magnetism or electricity is.
Mm-hmm.
And that this eventually formed the basis of his flying machines. And so he was going to publish this dynamic theory of gravity as a rebuttal to Einstein's explanation of the phenomenon. And he hoped to debunk the Einsteinian solution once and for all with this approach. The interesting thing was he never did it. It was just amazing. You know, he made a whole lot of noise about it, and
mm-hmm.
then he didn't do it. Just as if he had a last-minute change of mind.
Yeah, why do you think that was? I mean, well, you sort of answered the question with your last comment, but deeper than that, what do you think changed his mind?
Well, let's put it this way. He had already been amply, it had already been amply demonstrated, how vicious and thoughtless we'll call them the bankers, for lack of a better term, could be. I mean, they did him over pretty well with the world communication system at Warden Cliff, Long Island, and in other ways. And of course, the stuff that you've uncovered about how they were stealing his inventions and his wealth left and right.
Mm-hmm.
But over and above that, I think the other thing he was concerned about is the fact that anything and everything that those people lay their hands on becomes a weapon. And maybe he just didn't want to be responsible for unleashing that upon the world, at least not directly. So even though he was kicked off at Einstein enough to make the initial threat, I think maybe he had secondary thoughts about it and decided not to do it. And one of the reasons why I think he was annoyed at Einstein is because of the fact that, you know, Einstein made all of this hullabaloo about his theories of relativity and the interchangeability, let's use that word, of mass and energy and all these wonderful concepts that we take for granted today and always associate with Einstein's name. But in reality, all that stuff was written about 100 years before Tesla by another Serb. And the guy's name was Boscovic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Tesla was well aware of the fact that Einstein was exposed to Boscovic's work when he was acting as an examiner in the Swiss Patent Office. And I think he just decided to capitalize on his own arrangement of Boscovic's earlier writings. And that really ticked him off because you might say it's plagiarism. And so
yeah.
I think he wanted to set all that straight and released his initial frustration in the form of a threat, but then perhaps he decided not to do it.
Yeah, I'm not exactly clear on the year that Einstein came to the United States, but I would venture to guess it was at least after the war, maybe something around the time of Operation Paperclip. But the fact that he was in the Swiss Patent Office, to me, it always struck me funny, like he was there maybe because he had a photographic memory and he could absorb all that material. I don't know really how brilliant he was. He seemed to have gotten a lot more credit for his theories than he did for any inventions or anything like that. Certainly, you know, he was a thorn in Tesla's side. I agree with you there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's pretty well known that his greatest inventions were mathematical relationships. I don't think he was a hands-on person like Tesla was.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Tesla could wind his own motors. He could operate a lathe and a milling machine. You know, I mean, he had all of the necessary physical talents and coordinations to allow him to build his own models if he chose to do so. He also had the intellectual prowess required to think the things up and design them.
I don't think that
was Einstein's gift, you know.
Yeah.
His gift was in the direction of expressing abstract concepts in the form of mathematical relationships. But here's the thing that irks me about that whole thing. There's something very strange about the whole Einstein movement, if you want to call it that. Because when they set off the first bomb, and more or less verified to their own satisfaction that E equals MC squared was a valid relationship, it seems that from that point on, it didn't matter what Einstein said anymore. He was already a god of physics. But the interesting thing is, later in his own life, Einstein himself retracted a lot of his earlier statements and said, you know, that there's errors in the things that I did. They were they were half-truths or partial expressions that needed more work. And even though he made those comments himself, the physics world never picked up on it. It's like, yeah, we know, don't worry about it. We already got your number. And so,
well, maybe it was because they had invested so much in all the textbooks, you know, like, well, let's not spread this around because we don't want anybody to figure this out on their own. You know.
Well, I don't know. See, that to me is hypocrisy because
yes, I'm not justifying.
The definition you know, I'm not... of science is supposed to be, you know, the unbiased pursuit of truth.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying, you know, based on what we know from what we learned in school, there was certainly a lot of suppressed information, not just about science, you know, about history and about humanity in general and the universe. There was a lot to consider that was left off the plate, if you get my meaning. And, you know, I resent it, to tell you the truth, and I'm sure a lot of us our age resent the fact that these banksters, I'll call them banksters for you, they determined that you know, they were going to keep the people in the dark about all these things. It's a travesty, really it is, and it's really I feel more sorry for them than I do for us, I have to tell you, because they still think that that's going to work.
Well, they're probably incapable of thinking anything else, to be honest with you, because if they weren't convinced of the superiority of what they're doing, they wouldn't be doing it. You know, I mean, it's a protective mechanism of some sort. It's like, you know, it's like the Napoleon complex. You know, if you feel like a little runt, then you wind up doing everything to be a big shot. You know, to fool yourself. And that's what most of these guys are. They're just little runts. You know, the thing that's interesting about that whole deal, now that you brought it up, did you ever notice that they're always in the shadows? When would any of them have the nerve to come right out and tell somebody what they're doing? Never.
You know, I wrote something along those lines in my latest Three Stooges piece, where I made a comment that when you turn the lights on, the cockroaches go running, you know, for cover. Mm-hmm. And I hate to, and then I think I said something to the effect that I don't mean to demean cockroaches. So.
All right.
I may not have written it. I might have just said it to myself. But
well, it's pretty cool anyway.
Yeah.
But getting back to the question that you asked about why do you think he changed his mind, I think that maybe those were some of the reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not he actually built an airship or whether those were just projections, you know, he was very good at projecting into the future once he knew about something because he realized what the potential was and how it could be done. But I have a sneaking suspicion that he did build, let's just call them laboratory pieces, which he could have experimented with in privacy. Because, you know, there's no reason why he wouldn't do that. He did it with everything.
Yeah, like sort of like in I'm trying to think of it. I can't even think of the term of it now. An erector set.
A levitation? Oh, an erector set.
You know, sort of like a, you know, this part will fit this device and it'll fit this one here. And, you know, making all-purpose devices that sort of worked in a cross-platform kind of way. Is that what you mean, or?
Well, I meant more literally. In other words, he could have very easily built a small device, maybe, you know, 24 inches in diameter or something, and he could have flown it right in the privacy of his loft. Who would ever have known? You know?
Yeah. Maybe he did. Maybe that's why the pigeons came to see him all the time.
There you go.
You know?
Anything is possible. But I don't know about the pigeons, but I do know that Otis Carr came to see him, and that brings that brings us to the next step of this presentation, which is, was there or was there not a blue notebook? Now, I can tell you unequivocally that I saw the Blue Notebook on many occasions. The only thing I cannot tell you is whether or not it was an authentic piece of memorabilia, you know, directly descendant from Nikola Tesla. That I can't tell you because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that Getz got it from Carr, and Carini saw Carr with it on numerous occasions, consulting it in a kind of a biblical way. And in Carr's sworn statement to Carini was that he had obtained it from Tesla, although he didn't go into details as to how he got it. So I'm going to assume that there were things in that book that were legitimately descended from Tesla, whether the Blue Notebook was the original document or a copy or whatever. And I'm basing that statement on things that Carini taught me about the information concerning the OTCX1 and the OTCX2, which, of course, dribbled down to him from Carr during their association.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the vehicle was always referred to as a circular foil spacecraft, which is a very interesting terminology if you think about it, because the idea of a foil, among other things, brings to light the nature of a capacitor. And it's very evident from other things that I've learned over the years that this ship was designed to have two halves, an upper and a lower flange, and they were charged with respect to one another.
Mm-hmm.
But so the whole ship was, in a sense, at least part of it, operating as a capacitor. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, though, is that I don't know if you know this or not, but there are two types of electric charge. Since we're talking about capacitors, I'll start with the charge that normally resides on the plates of a capacitor. That's referred to as a bound charge. And the reason for the term bound charge is because it always requires two charges. Or you might say the charge that you want to discuss and the absence of that charge. So like if I displace an electron from a plate and I bring it over and stick it on the opposite plate, and then after I've done that work to separate those two charges, you know, I open the connection between the two plates. Even though there's no immediate path for that electron to get back where it was stolen from, there's a line of stress, or if you want to call it that, that connects that electron to its original position in the other plate.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you define the electron's charge as being negative, then the hole that it came out of is positive, and the line that attaches, or the spring-like force that attaches that electron to its point of origin is an electric field line. And as a result of that you're looking at a pair of charges connected by a line of stress or strain, and that constitutes bound charge, because essentially it's bound to its other half. And the first opportunity that it gets, it'll rush back across the gap and assume its original position. But that's not the only kind of charge that there is. There's also unbound charge, which is associated with magnetism and motion. And that kind of charge is very interesting because it has its other polarity, if you want to call it that, at infinity. So like, for instance, if we have a plate, or let's look at a sphere. If we have a sphere that's charged, but it's not charged with respect to anything, then the lines of force will radiate out spherically from that point, and they will be seeking their counterpart, you know, way off in the regions of space somewhere. So for all intents and purposes, you call that infinity. Well, the reason why that's a very important thing is because a bound charge, if you try to influence it with, let's say, an electric field, for instance, you really can't do anything with it because it's like two masses separated by the center of mass. It's really only one thing. And so acting as a totality, it doesn't have a charge with respect to an external force.
Does that make it a multidimensional object in terms of how it operates?
It's just the opposite. It makes it a very predictable, two-dimensional, phenomenon. But the opposite is, can be said about the unbound charge, because since it has, it's stabilized at a point in space, with these lines going out infinitely in every direction, it can be operated upon by an external electric field. And so, that puts it in a very unique category. The only problem is, how do you make it? How do you produce it artificially? Now, this brings us to a situation called the motional electric field, which was investigated exclusively in modern times, at least, by a guy by the name of Dr. Hooper. And Hooper set up some very elaborate experiments, and I have all his notes. I was very fortunate that I didn't get to meet Hooper himself, but unfortunately, when I located him, he had passed away only a few months before, and his secretary was very understanding about my interest in his work, and for a small fee, she allowed me to copy all of his notes. So I have a lot of Hooper's original stuff, and in there, he talks about his experimental investigations with the motional magnetic field. And I have to tell you that there's a world of difference between the magnetic field, which is stationary in space, and one which is in motion in space. If you have a stationary magnetic field, you can shield it. So, like, for instance, we want to keep magnetism out of a little space over here. We just build a box, let's say, made out of a very high permeability material, like mu metal, for instance. And the lines of flux will go into that the fabric of that box, and they will deliberately avoid the space beyond. So in that sense, you're shielding whatever is in the box from the magnetic field. But that very same magnetic field, if it was in motion and it encountered that shield, it would just cut through it like butter. As a matter of fact, what Hooper concluded was that that there is no distinguishing characteristic between a magnetic field in motion through space and certain aspects of a gravitational field, because there's nothing that will shield it, and it will cut through anything and affect all matter in its path. And so I was very interested in this, and I saw immediately relationships that could be developed between the motion of this special field that Hooper was talking about and its ability to produce unbound charge. Now, it's interesting to note also that in the OTCX1 design, you had rotating magnetic fields and also rotating electric fields that were designed into the hull of the ship. So it was very definitely designed to produce emotional electric fields, which in turn would give rise to this unbound charge. Now, you have to realize that if you have unbound charge of a strong enough measure, and you produce this with the right polarity on the face of the Earth, the planet itself essentially constitutes a large spherical capacitor, one plate being the surface of the Earth and the other plate being the ionosphere, which is charged by the sun itself. So theoretically, if you had a device like this, it could easily move without any obvious external force between the surface of the planet and the outermost reaches of space. And it could do so with the same facility as an electron does when it bounces around between two charged plates. So the reason I bring this up is because I'm hypothesizing that the mechanism that Tesla was using to produce the effect that gave him the notion that gravity was a dynamic field of force may very well have been the motional magnetic field, which he had every reason to experiment with because it was the basis of his earliest work, the rotating magnetic field.
Now, so, I have a question, and I don't know if I'm jumping the gun or not, but let's say in terms of a magnetic field and the way I understand a spaceship operates, the spaceship would operate basically through the principle of anti-gravity while in the atmosphere that's affected by the gravity, and once outside of that field, you go into antimatter. What you're describing, I'm trying to visualize how, and this is where I say I might be jumping the gun a little bit. If I am, just stop me. This concept of folding space and pulling space towards you as opposed to pushing yourself through it. You know, this phenomenon that's been described by people that have been around ships, maybe even worked on them or flown them. I'm trying to draw a parallel to what you're describing because I'm visualizing, you know, these forces doing their thing and at what point one might take over for the other. And if these rules just stop applying or these laws of physics stop and the new one takes over, or is it a gradual process or what? I don't know.
Well, I think the anti-gravity aspect of this whole thing probably is what propels the ship through the Earth's atmosphere. And I also believe that if it got high enough to where it was starting to get outside the charge density necessary to impose forces upon the vehicle, that's when it would shift over to the antimatter drive. But I honestly don't know enough about how that thing works to venture an explanation. I mean, I can think of several possible explanations. But my real focus was always on the anti-gravity aspect rather than the deep space drive. Maybe it's just because that's where my personal interests were directed.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the thing that's interesting about this, Don, is that it brings us to a possible realization that gravity winds up being related to the Lenz force in a relativistic way, and therefore, as some of the earliest investigators believed, it finds itself more related to electricity than anything else. And that makes perfect sense to me on an intuitive level.
Yeah. Now, we were talking about that last week, Jim, when you described the phenomenon of the sun or the moon rising and how it appears to be larger when it's either coming up from the horizon or going down behind the horizon, and the lens effect there. What is the difference of the electrical makeup that causes that phenomenon? Is that just the shape of the grid? Let's say if we visualize, I think you and I talked about this last week off the air, sort of like we were talking about a parabolic grid, similar to a vortex, but something that sort of tapers off at the end as it moves away from the Earth.
Well, the grid that you're talking about, if I remember the conversation correctly, is, in a sense, the lines of force that are described as permeating the entire universe in three dimensions. And essentially, it's the nodes where these lines intersect that causes the formation of a vortex.
Okay.
And then the vortex itself eventually assembles a planet or a star or a moon, you know, depending on its size and its frequency. And that's the basic concept that most of these people who really deeply think about this stuff seem to have come up with. What's interesting, this priest that I was mentioning earlier, and by the way, his name is Father Andrew J.K. Glaswoski. And after his name is L.TH. And that has something to do with theology, but I was never really able to figure out whose order the guy might have been associated with. The only thing I can tell you is that he wrote this fantastic letter in 1950, which was actually written, and it was unsolicited, by the way, was actually written in support of Carr's concept. And this guy, I mean, it's about a, I'm just guessing here, I haven't really counted the pages, but it's about 10 or 12 pages long. 13 pages altogether. So it's a fairly sizable letter, and it goes into a great amount of detail concerning the nature of space, the nature of matter, the difference between mass and matter, the difference between mass and energy, and all of these various things, you know, some of which gets to be pretty deep. But the interesting thing is that it starts out with a, and I don't remember what page it's on, but it starts out with the concept that space. Oh, here it is, right here. It's on the front. It's on the first page. Yeah, I'll read it to you. It says space tends to be continuous and isotropic, and it may be represented by multiple parallel lines or planes. Any disturbance in space, so conceived, distorts the parallel arrangement. It is another aspect of gravitational potential that tends to ununiformity. So he then goes on to elaborate on all of these introductory concepts. But the point is that you know, he later describes the fact that these so-called parallel lines, which incidentally gets talked about, Carini talked about, Carr talked about, so I wouldn't be surprised if Tesla talked about it. They just refer to them as lines of force. What this guy goes into is the fact that wherever there is matter produced in space by whatever mechanism, that there are tensor lines and lines of strain or stress on the fabric of space itself, which of course is the ether. And those lines of strain, or those tensor fields, can mathematically be mapped as parallel lines which distort in the neighborhood of a an isolated body in space, for instance. But the interesting thing is that the math seems to suggest, yeah, there are lines out there. There are these lines of force or lines of strain, whatever you choose to call them.
And now, so, it's pretty, you know, I was going to say, Jim, excuse me, it's pretty well accepted amongst metaphysicians and probably some scientists that every time we explode a nuclear weapon within the atmosphere of the Earth, we are tearing the fabric of time and space. What has anyone ever actually attempted to see what that looks like? In other words,
damage looks like?
Yeah, the grid. What does it do to the grid that you're describing? Or because basically that's what you're describing. I mean, how it functions is one thing, but it's got to wreak havoc with the ethereal realms. I would venture to guess.
Well, it probably would. Let me share an interesting thought with you. You know, I got in trouble over this too a number of years back, you know, it's the kind of information that I think would be really interesting if it could ever be verified. One of the most stunning things that that Warren Goetz ever told me was that if a large enough disturbance was manifest in close proximity to the surface of a planet, that you could literally cause a disconnect between the lines of force that feed the vortex and the vortex itself. Now, that doesn't mean the vortex would necessarily disappear, but according to what he was theorizing, it did mean that it could no longer absorb energy from this spatial grid. So I said to him, well, what would be the consequence of that, you know? And he said, well, it's very simple. He said, let's take the example of the moon. He said, everybody thinks that the moon lights up because it reflects the sun's rays.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but that's only part of the picture. He said, the sun supplies an ionization potential which travels along these lines, and then when it reaches the vortex of the moon, it's sucked down into that spiral and causes a glow in the hydrogen atmosphere that's surrounding the moon. Of course, according to Goetz, hydrogen was one of the first atmospheres that forms on any planet. So even though the moon doesn't have a breathable atmosphere, it has enough hydrogen around it to cause this glow that we perceive as moonlight. Now, whether that's true or not, I really don't know. And I'm not going to venture a guess on it. But that's not the point I wanted to make. The point that I wanted to share was the next statement, which is extraordinary. Now, he said, as you know, Goetz's story was that he was schooled by aliens since he was a kid. And they taught him universal law. And they taught him the true aspects of spatial mechanics and all this other stuff. Because sooner or later, he would be responsible for introducing this to earthlings that wanted to expand their consciousness. So I listen to all this stuff, usually with a certain amount of leeriness, but also with great interest. Now, he claimed that the Earth actually has two moons, and that it's a well-known fact that it's got two moons. The problem is that one of the moons, the vortex is ruptured and does not make contact with the lines of force, and so it's a dark moon.
Yeah.
Now, here's the part that's interesting. If that were true, it would stand the scientific community on their ear if it was a well-known fact, because you got the one moon that lights up every night, and you got this other dead moon that doesn't do anything, but it's still orbiting the Earth. So that really bothered me, and I made some inroads to a couple of observatories through some people that I knew in New York. actually the guy is now deceased, unfortunately, but
Right.
No, he didn't show me anything.
Oh.
But what he did do was get superhumanly annoyed that you know, that people were making this inquiry and putting him on the spot. And the answer that he came back, he never said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. There's no such thing as a dark moon." But you know, he had this far too emotional response for even a silly question. You know what I mean? And he didn't just say, "Well, you know, you guys are all nuts. We all know that the moon reflects the sun's light." Period. It wasn't like that. It was like, he went on and on about all kinds of stuff that had nothing to do with the question and was too annoyed at being asked the question. Like something else was bothering him, you know.
Like a politician.
So I never really got to the bottom of it, but I'll tell you one thing. If it was proven that the Earth has a dark moon, and that's something that somebody ought to be able to find out, that would in itself shed a lot of light on a lot of things. So
I'll tell you something that I strongly, I don't want to say believe, I feel is going to happen, and it's not going to be that long from now. I feel there is another moon, and it's no big deal other than the impact it's going to have on the Earth, but the Earth, in its condition, in its state right now, and that's because of man and what mankind has done to the moon, and that's really not the appropriate word, because it wasn't a kind thing that man did. Humanity, let's say, especially the military-industrial complex, they have, you know, destroyed the aura of this planet, and so we have no idea what we would see or what we would know if they weren't doing the things to it and us that they do. And I think we're going to move into a higher vibration where we'll be able to see that. In fact, that will probably bring back its light, I would guess. And we'll know it's there.
That would be really something to look up there and magically all of a sudden see two moons. You know, that would definitely get somebody's attention. You know, even the dim-witted fungus heads of the Earth would sort of notice the extra moon.
You'd have to rewrite a lot of songs, though. You know, it'd be like, "By the light of the silvery moons," and you have to put the S's on there, and it'll just change everything, you know. "Shoot the moons," you'll have to say. So,
well, anyway, my point was that, you know,
moons. Go ahead.
My point was that there may very well be a lot of mysteries that we're not even aware of, simply because if there are people who know, they've been instructed to keep their mouth shut.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty much accepted in metaphysical circles, I'll say. There are a lot of metaphysicians know about that because they sense things that are around them more than they did a few years ago. What I think of, Jim, in terms of when that event took place, that other moon went into the darkness, think of the impact that would have had on the rest of the universe. And vice versa. I think we're affected by many of the things that are going on in other parts of the universe. It's not just us doing it, it's everything doing it. And these energies are constantly, you know, morphing from one state to another. That's what I feel. I mean, if you take in positive light and turn it into negative, that's got to really have a funky impact on the universe.
Well, I think everything has an effect on the universe, regardless of how small, but I can tell you this much. It would certainly have had an effect on the people of Earth at whatever time that occurred, because, you know, that's a big event. In other words, you grow up and you see two moons all your life, and then one day the other one is just not there anymore. The interesting thing about it is, unless it happened, you know, many thousands of years ago, like let's say before the last ice age, for instance, because at that point we don't have records to go back that far. But if it was any time between now and about 7,500 years ago, I would actually expect to see it mentioned in some record somewhere. Now, there are a lot of unusual things that are mentioned, and some of them are pretty fantastic. But the Popol Vuh, which is the Bible of the Aztecs, or the Incas, I forget which, to be honest with you. But anyway, that is a pretty ancient document. And in there they talk about a time when the sun rose in the west and set in the east, which is a pretty phenomenal thing. And of course, when people read it, they go, you know, they just had their directions mixed up. Well, you know, that's pretty idiotic. If you live here any number of years, you can pretty well figure out which way is north, south, east, and west. And if something really enormously happened to change, you know, the way things worked and what you were used to all your life, I'm sure that it would affect you enough to write it down correctly. But for some reason, we don't want to hear that stuff. Now, there's another interesting thing, too. I forget which aspect of the Bible it was, but it was some one of those situations where the Israelites were fighting somebody, as they always were, and
take your pick.
Yeah, and the sun froze in the sky so that they had an extra long day to finish their battle, you know, and that was perceived as a miracle of God. Well, the interesting thing is that if there was a shift of the Earth's crust during that time period, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be aware of its motion themselves, depending on how violent it was. But if it was moving in a direction that countered the normal cycle of the sun, to the people involved, it would definitely appear that the sun wasn't moving in the sky. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we can look at from a slightly different perspective and gain some really interesting insights into what really was behind so-called miracles. I mean, I think God has enough to do with whatever he does in this entire universe that he doesn't have to physically take part in every little thing that happens on Mother Earth. I mean, if that was the case, then he would be doing similar duties on every planetary object throughout the universe, which strikes me as a waste of time because he's already set up these rules and these laws, and now he's free to observe the workings of the whole thing. I don't think he has to fiddle with these things.
Yeah, he doesn't have to influence it, but what about the God aspect within us that's still connected?
Well, that's a different story, and I think that's where we're allowed to take a certain amount of license in cherishing the expression that we are created in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't think we look like God. I think that's an absurdity. But I think that we're equipped with a certain amount of intellect and a certain amount of creative energies that we are allowed to use as we see fit, with the total understanding, though, that we are also responsible for whatever we produce. So if we produce good things, they're going to have good and natural repercussions, which is commendable. And if we screw up, then we have to accept the responsibility for our stupidity. And
you know, I'm sorry, I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it doesn't appear that there's any limit to how badly we can screw up.
Yeah. You had made a comment, you know, that God was smart in making us look different. I'm paraphrasing what you said. You know, it was brilliant. And I'm thinking to myself, can you imagine if we looked all the same, and we got up to heaven, and I said, are you God? And I got back, no, I'm Roseanne Barr. You know, I think it would make things kind of confusing, too, in a sense.
I don't think there's going to ever be a problem of not being able to distinguish between the divine being and any one of us, whether we got the skin on or not.
Yeah. So just for clarification, you're not saying someone is actually asking. You're not saying that God created or God didn't create all things. What you're saying is we play a role in the creative process. I mean, that's part of why we're here. We're creating our experience.
Well, I'm also saying that I don't think he has to monitor everything that he's already created. I mean, whatever God is, you know, was brilliant enough to come up with sets of laws, you know, based on the way the universe is fabricated, so that it runs like a watch. You know, it's a fine-tuned thing, and it's going to operate in a certain way and continue to do so, unless we really, you know, get to the point where we can interfere with it, which is what we're doing here. But I don't think that he has to sit there at the throttle, so to speak, and monitor the happenings on every world. I think that would be demeaning to the true nature of the being that was capable of conjuring all this up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I'm just posing the question as it was asked. So thank you for answering that.
Yeah, well, anyway, getting back to this mysterious father of Glauswski, or Glauswski, he has an opening comment here which is worth reading. It's only a paragraph long. It says, "It is assumed that electricity, as it appears to an observer in the proper reference frame, consists of a sudden drop or change of gravitational potential at a locus or area in space in relation to the surroundings where the distribution of this potential is comparatively isotropic. Such change of gravitational potential is noticed as electricity by an observer standing outside this closed physical system, and therefore existing in a relatively ununiformly distributed potential pertaining to his own state." So he's really saying that electricity and gravity are relativistic aspects of the same thing. And this is a fascinating thing, because it's like we already know that there's a relativistic relationship between electrostatic phenomenon and magnetism. If you have a bunch of people standing on a merry-go-round and they're all holding charged spheres on an insulated handle, when the merry-go-round is stationary and we look at that with some kind of an instrument, we could see, oh yeah, look, each one of those guys has a sphere, and the sphere is registering, I don't know, pick a number, 200,000 volts of potential. Now we start up the merry-go-round and we spin it at a good clip, and the instrument that we used to measure the electrostatic potential no longer reads anything. But the instrument that we have mounted next to it, which reads a magnetic vector potential, suddenly says, hey, look, there's now a magnetic field around this merry-go-round. So it's the same thing. Nothing has changed except that we suddenly, by rotating the merry-go-round, put the charge into a relativistic reference frame different from the one occupied by the observer. And what this priest is saying is that gravity is the same kind of a thing but it's a little bit different form of reference frame is all. And so whenever we perceive a drop in electric potential in our environment, that if you were in the proper reference frame, you'd see a shift in gravitational potential due to the same phenomenon. Now, that is a very, very interesting and thought-provoking situation. And I have given a lot of thought over the years to how you would design an experiment to test that. And I came to the conclusion that you can't do it so easily because any experiment of that sort that is actually performed on the surface of the planet is automatically in the wrong reference frame to allow you to observe those results. So you would almost have to do it in conjunction with a reference point beyond the planet, like International Space Station or something, which puts it outside my immediate financial abilities.
Now, I just had a thought, I'm visualizing all kinds of stuff in space while you're talking, and I'm wondering, did NASA go to the dark moon, you think?
I don't know, but we could conjure up a letter and send it to NASA and see if it solicits, a really superhuman emotional response.
Guy says, no, that's the wrong name. I'm Roseanne Barr. That thought just entered my mind, I guess, because if we think outside the box, certainly that could be possible. I don't know. You know, I have some doubts, although I know today that they're up there, but when they claim to have gone, I think they're already up on Mars, actually. And, that was just a diversion. I think they wanted to let us know what they were capable of doing, and that was sort of a primer on it. I feel very strongly about that. You're talking 7 years prior, and then because they're always slow in letting the technology out to us anyway, even in consumer products. These things we have now are prehistoric,
Probably much more so than we realize, too,
And I mean, they've designed them to keep the vibration low, which leads me to a question I want to ask you. When you were describing the vibrations, and let's say if they're in their correct state, in a perfect state, and all these energy fields are balanced, with what they're doing on this planet with low frequencies, what impact would that have on those fields?
Well, that's a good question, and I would have to sort of ponder the answer because I certainly don't know directly. But let's put it this way. There is a thing called sympathetic resonance, mm-hmm. which is a very powerful phenomenon. And, if we wind up producing some sort of a really powerful ultra-low frequency disturbance that has definite periodicity to it, it's going to eventually cause a response in whatever natural phenomenon beats at the same frequency or close to it. Now, we already know, for instance, that there's some really low frequencies associated with the planet itself. I think one of them was like 7.25 cycles per second, and then there's another, a second octave of that, around 15 cycles per second or something. And if you start messing with that, that now you're screwing around with something which is like one of the foundational notes of the very planet that we live on. And only a madman would mess with something like that without understanding it. You know what it reminds me of? I remember when when they first started going to the moon or attempting to get to the moon or whatever they were doing. And there was some pinhead genius that came up with a brilliant idea. If we get to the moon, let's set off a hydrogen bomb up there and see what happens. Can you imagine? I mean, just the thought. Let's see what happens.
Well, it wouldn't be that strange because they do it down here. I mean, if you think about it, isn't it a bit insane to do that down here?
Well, sure it is. As a matter of fact, you know, when Oppenheimer was first proposing the ignition of an atomic bomb, which is actually a smaller explosion than most hydrogen bombs, there was a certain amount of concern among some pretty prominent physicists at the time that they might inadvertently ignite the atmosphere. You know, because of the sudden burst of heat and the possibility that there could be fusion reactions that could spread, you know, throughout the, I forget which compounds were involved. I think it was nitrogen and oxygen. That they might fuse under those conditions and then propagate across the planet and essentially burn out the atmosphere. They tried it anyway.
Yeah, and they're messing with microwaves too. I mean, what do you think the microwave network that they use for communications, you know, cell phones and all this, what impact is that having on the atmosphere from what you know?
Well, I can tell you this much. I was personally involved a number of years ago with a relative of a guy that worked on the Dew Line, which was the original radar cluster that was set up in Alaska and across the northern perimeter of Canada to look at any kind of missiles coming this way from Russia. And essentially, you know, a radar unit is nothing more than a big microwave transducer. If the only thing that's different about it is it's equipped with both a transmitter and a receiver. But essentially, it's like a giant microwave oven with the door open. And at any rate, they had some kind of a big ice storm or something, and there was some damage to part of the plastic cone that protects the transducer. And so they sent some poor slob in there to change it. And there was somebody of exceptionally small mental capacity who just happened to be passing through and noticed that the main switch was pulled. And as a dutiful individual that certainly wanted to protect his nation, you know, he couldn't tolerate the switch being open. But of course, without asking any questions, he just flipped it up. And of course, the guy was in the horn when he did that. And needless to say, he was cooked from the inside out, just like what happens when you put a hamburger in a microwave. So the point is that type of radiation, the way that it does the cooking from the inside out is because the water molecules in whatever the substance involved is absorbs this radiation. It happens to be at the proper frequency for that to occur. And then when the excited atoms collapse back, they release that energy at a lower thermal level than what they took it in as. And so there's this constant reaction of transforming from the megacycle range, the high megacycle range, you know, into the heat range, and then the heat cooks whatever it happens to be, whatever the water molecules happen to be in. Well, don't forget that the atmosphere contains a lot of water molecules.
Yeah.
And when we're beaming this crap back and forth, you know, we don't really, to my knowledge, I mean, I worked for AT&T Long Lines Division. We had microwave couplings that went from New York City clean over to Morristown, New Jersey. And that's quite a distance. I think it's like 14 miles or 18 miles, whatever, and as the crow flies. And nobody was ever particularly concerned about, you know, what happened to the energy. It was just measured. There was so many dB down at the receiving end, and as long as they got a good crisp signal that they could reconstruct the main message from, they were very happy. But, you know, now you've got these things all over the world.
Yeah, that's why I asked that question, because it seems to have a way, you know, I'm not just talking about what it might do to the atmosphere. I'm also thinking about what it does to these grid lines that you were describing, you know, multidimensionally, what's going on there. Because, you know, a low frequency also is a standing wave. It keeps traveling until it strikes something that is capable of absorbing it. Otherwise, it just keeps refracting or reflecting. And I'm sure that, you know, with everything that's going on, there's got to be something like that occurring that's really not helping matters any.
Well, I'll tell you something else that's not helping matters any, which is pretty interesting. And I can't take credit for the original thought either. Believe it or not, it was Goetz that mentioned this. And he said that, you know, in the ancient times, the magnetic lines of force flowing from one pole to another were essentially uninterfered with, and they moved across the planet in serpentine-type motions, which were primarily determined by the terrain of the land. And the sensitives of that era, you know, could see how this energy was moving and knew the ramifications of the motions. And that's the way in which they determined where to put temples, where to put, you know, various structures like water pools for healing and all this stuff. And the energy was simply referred to as the dragon. Well, now, the interesting thing is you've got highways all over the planet. And these highways are active most of the time with tens of thousands of automobiles and trucks and any other kind of vehicle that they can get on there. And these are primarily made of steel. Now, the nature of magnetism is such that the steel represented by these artificial causeways and all of the vehicles that are sitting on them is a much easier path for the flux to follow, especially if the route is approximately north and south. So what we're doing is, whether we know it or not, we're rechanneling the magnetic forces of the planet in such a way that the flux lines are saying, well, what's the sense of rolling across the countryside when we got this beautiful pathway straight down the center of the state or the country or whatever it is, which allows us to travel much more freely. But in doing that, it locks it in so that you now have, as long as there are vehicles moving on these paths, you now have this this channel, if you want to call it that, of magnetic activity, where the lines of flux are actually locked into the position determined by the highway, and they're no longer free to move across the countryside. Now, we have no clue what the absence of flux does in such things as purifying water, the growth of plants, the distribution of plant growth, even the intelligence and the health of people and animals. We have no clue, and nobody is even worried about it. But I can tell you this much, in ancient times, when there were no highways, and the lines of force actually wiggled across the surface of the planet, there was much more magical activity in the sense that humans were actually cognizant of this energy's function. And even though not everybody got involved with it, the people that did were the ones that were called the magicians and the wizards and what have you. And in China, they were associated with feng shui. And, you know, in Egypt and South America, they built pyramids that deliberately deflected these lines because they understood the ramifications of intensifying that energy locally. And so, you know, we have so far moved away from the original layout of this planet and from an understanding of its design and function into this unreal world that we've created, mostly because of ambition and greed, but primarily because of ignorance of divine law.
Now, you know what's insane since you mentioned that, and we've got to close here in a couple of minutes. We have this what they're calling cap and trade, which is basically being taxed for producing carbon dioxide. Think of that insanity. I mean, that gives global warming a run for her money. If you want to put it that way. I mean, this is ridiculous what they're trying to do.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you to explain what's going on with carbon dioxide in the natural environment. And that, you cannot make a distinction between the natural and the unnatural if you work for the government. That's not going to happen.
Well, the irony of it is it takes us back to something that has always stuck in my craw over the years, and that was that ridiculous study that they made back in the 70s or 80s on the effects of bovine flatulence. You know, I mean, there you go with... Well, I mean, it's the same type of insanity. You know, there are lots of things that produce carbon dioxide... and methane and all these other gases, and they've been doing so for eons without our consent, without our concern, without our interference. And now all of a sudden, all these natural things are suddenly suspect simply because the gases involved are similar or the same to those produced in various human activities like industrial processes and what have you. It's just another ripoff.
They seem to have this preoccupation with for things made of gas, bovine flatulence and swamp gas. You know, I mean, swamp gas. That's a good one.
There's a good reason for it, though, Don, when you stop and think of it. How are you going to argue the point? You know, they got some yo-yo that's examining this phenomenon, and he's using an instrument that costs $20,000, and the average individual's got nothing to go by but his nose.
So, and his brains.
Well, yeah, but those are often lacking. So, you know, you're in a predicament where you're forced to accept, which way am I going to lean with this thing? Do I trust my senses, or do I trust the government guy over there with the multi-million-dollar machine who's printing out all of these reports and warnings? You know, the public is already brainwashed. They don't believe anything that the authorities tell them, you know?
Yeah. I agree. Well, Jim, we're about out of time. Do you want to make a closing comment on tonight's show? We probably have some engineering students listening to us that might be interested in what you might say to them to motivate them.
Well, here's a good closing remark, which was actually I actually planned to read it a few minutes ago, but we got off on this gaseous adventure, and it didn't happen. The conclusion of this priest's letter is really pretty interesting, and I'll just narrow it down to two separate sentences, which I think we have time for. It says that the tendency is to reduce all phenomenon to electricity, including that of gravity. But then in his closing remark, he says, but as Mr. Faraday himself describing his earlier experiments to link gravity and electricity, and he couldn't make any proof in that direction simply because the process needs to be reversed. And then what he basically says is all phenomena need to be reduced to various expressions of gravity, which is really kind of interesting because if you look at it from the more universal perspective, that's exactly what you would see. I mean, all of the forces, you know, that make astronomy work are gravitational. And yet when you get down on the surface of one of these planets, we have the tendency to see everything as electrical. So it's like two sides of the same coin. And I think that's worth thinking about because our tendency to look at everything from the electrical standpoint is essentially a deduction that we make because we're imprisoned in a particular reference frame. And if we move outside that reference frame, the same causes for the same phenomenon may turn out to be a totally different force. And the only person I know of that seemed to have tendency to look in that direction was Dirac. And the only difference was that Dirac related gravity and time instead of gravity and electricity. But even there might be a link. So anyway, in closing, I think that for anybody that's really interested in this stuff, there's plenty to ponder, and we're a long ways from knowing it all.
Yeah, I agree. Jim, it's been very interesting. I could go on for hours more every Friday night.
Well, we can always continue, you know.
Yeah, we got to let the guys get home. I'm going to think about this over the week because I think we would do some good to take this to a different level and if you want to experiment and contemplate what all might be going on in the spiritual realm, because that's the reality of our being here. Certainly the physical realm, the physical reality has to play a part, but it's really been abused, and the consciousness that is pervasive here is a reflection of the low frequencies that are dominating. And they can only be destructive over time. You know what a standing wave does to a window. You know, if it's, but a high frequency tone can do the same thing in another way. And I think there's a point where energies have to be balanced and intention and integrity has to be balanced. We've got to get out of these low frequencies. And I, you know, I don't know how you feel about that, but if you're interested, I'd enjoy it.
I'm interested in everything. That's part of the problem. But I'm happy to explore anything you want, Doc.
Okay. Well, Jim, thanks a lot for being on Evident Footprints tonight. And I wish I could give out a website for your work. But anyone that's interested in seeing a dual synchronous capacitor that Jim built a number of years ago, for a steel company, and you'd enjoy just looking at the size of what he's talking about. So this is in an industrial application, so it's going to be large, and but I'm sure your ingenuity played a role in keeping it as small as it was, too.
Well, that and the purse strings.
That and the purse strings, yeah. But people can go to my website, directlightproductions.com, to see that. Also, I'm hoping, I may not make it tonight, it is kind of late, but I'm in the process of posting part 7 of The Three Stooges Go to Washington. You're going to enjoy that for sure. And I'm making it easy on the eyes and getting all the photos and everything in order. It's a chore, believe me. But you have that to look forward to. Definitely it'll be on by tomorrow. If I get a second wind, I'll try to finish it tonight. But that might be improbable. Anyway, Jim, thanks for being on the show, and I look forward to seeing you next Friday. And same with the listening audience, except tune in on Monday. I may have a surprise guest on Monday. Special thanks to Don Newsom and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Don's on the sound tonight, so thank you, and a shout out to Seth. And to you in the listening audience, listening to us around the world on BBSRadio.com, Wind Talkers Radio, and also... I went blank for a second because I'm looking at my clock. Blog Talk Radio. There we go. Okay. I had to think of my buddy Drew Raines. Okay. Nice to have you folks with us. And I wish everyone a great weekend. And in the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light. And have a good day or good night.